Okay, a little bit about what's going on this week. If you've looked at the schedule, you'll notice that we've got the second exam on Thursday. And I know it seems like we just had one because we did. The original intent was that they're supposed to be about 3 weeks apart, you know, equally spaced. But because the last one got put off, it kind of makes this one seem like it comes up rather quickly. Yeah.
This Thursday?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. If you look at the schedule here, you can see the where we are, and we're actually kind of caught up on the lectures. But so today we're going to start this unit on U.S. classification system, and as far as the material that'll be on this test, it's going to be everything starting with relief as a soil forming factor. So it's relief, parent material, and time, as we covered as soil forming factors. And then we did the section on weathering and minerals, and then whatever we get through today, all right? So that'll be the scope of the material. And somebody asked me comprehensive. In other words, is it material from the entire semester? And I guess the answer is kind of yes and no. I mean, there is going to be some terminology that we've had before, right? Just because we haven't covered texture specifically in the last several weeks doesn't mean that you're not expected to know, you won't be expected to know anything about texture or some of the other terms. But anyway, so it won't be a whole lot of material, but then it's probably about the same in terms of the amount of material on the other quizzes. I've also posted there's old exams on there, and you can look at those if you want to get an idea of some of the questions. And what I'll do Thursday morning, since we'll be taking the quiz Thursday, or the exam Thursday afternoon, what I'll do is give you some time on Thursday morning if you want to go over some of the questions, okay? So any questions about that? Okay, and then the other thing for Thursday, I still don't know what the weather is going to be like, but I would like to try and go out for a short field trip if we can. So when you're laying out your wardrobe for Thursday, if it looks like it might be reasonably nice, then I would like to try and go. Then this first field trip has got three or four stops, and they're not really long stops. We're not going to be out digging or anything like that. So if there's a chance of maybe a little bit of precip, we probably will still go. I just don't want to go in a snowstorm where you can't see anything. This time of the year, the weather forecast changes quite a bit from day to day, so we'll just have to stay tuned. Okay, any questions then? About what's up for this week? All right, well, what I want to do is take a little bit of time, and we're going to get into the U.S. classification system, and in fact, that's what we're doing for the next few weeks. And this is really about soil taxonomy, and what I'd like to do this morning is spend a little time talking about how soil taxonomy came about. In other words, what sort of the philosophy behind it and some of the history that made it pretty much what it is. So I think maybe to start off, it might be good just to consider a couple bigger questions. And I guess the first one is, why do we even have a classification system for soils? A lot of people find this surprising that we've got this involved scheme for classifying soils, or dirt as they might call it. But you know, when you think about it, I know all of you have had a class, I'm sure, where you've discussed other types of classification systems. And what are some of the advantages and I guess the perks of developing a classification scheme for any sort of a natural object, whether it's a plant or plants, animals, soils, what have you? Why do we classify things?
Keep things organized.
Okay, it helps organize knowledge, right? And that's really one of the big points. Why else besides organize knowledge?
So you can put a Latin term with it and make everybody learn it?
Well, I don't know if that's really the objective, but that's kind of what ends up happening. You're right.
Well, I mean, it's like universal language.
Okay, it's a language thing, and that's sort of a good point to make, is that it helps with communication. For example, if I say, all right, this morning I got up, took the dog out, and I saw this brown thing, and it had four legs, and it was running, and you don't have any idea what I'm talking about, unless I keep explaining, right? But if I say I saw a deer, then immediately you've got a mental picture of a deer. You know exactly what I'm talking about. So it really does foster communication. Can you think of any other reasons why classification or even soil classification would be useful?
It reduces confusion when it comes to like subjectiveness.
What's an example?
Hue and color, I guess, would be an example.
Okay.
The Munsell book tells you exactly like what color it is, whereas somebody can say, oh, it's kind of a lighter brown, and they'll say that's kind of a darker brown.
Okay, so it really does establish true limits or a range of characteristics for certain things.
Right.
Like if we talk about a mollisol, we know that there's a pretty exact definition of what that is. And I guess the other thing I can think of is really extrapolation of research. You know, if you're thinking about a science where you do things. For example, if you're growing wheat around here and you're playing around with different fertilizer rates and you're looking at the yields, didn't sound good. You know, that's probably very useful information, but how do you go about extrapolating that to other places in the world? Well, I think one way is if you think about these soils, and you could say, well, this works on mollisols that are in azeric moisture regime and blah, blah, blah. That kind of helps you think about, well, we might expect something similar to happen in other places where you have those types of soils and so on. Maybe not so applicable to the humid tropics. You know, so it helps with extrapolation of research. So, or what you might call information transfer. Well, as far as the system in the United States, I know that most of you have been exposed to soil taxonomy at least a little bit. You might have learned the soil orders and soil 205. And what I'd like to do is go through just a little bit of the history that kind of led to where we are today. And I think it's kind of useful to see how the whole system evolved. So what I've done is put together a little bit of background on this, like starting with this guy, V.V. Dukachev, which if you've never heard the name before, this guy is also known as the father of pedology. And what's interesting is he's Russian, and he is probably the first person that ever thought about soils as being a natural body out on the landscape, and that there's this systematic variation in soils that you can attribute to vegetation and climate and things of that sort. And he was doing work in the Moscow area, it's Moscow, Russia, back in the 1880s, so just, you know, 130 years ago. 120 years ago, so really not that long ago. But as I said, he really is credited as being the first person to express this idea of soils that on a landscape that change in a systematic fashion as a result of essentially soil forming factors. But all the work that he did was in Russia, and he didn't speak English, and there wasn't a lot of communication between the countries, so we didn't really know much about it in this country. But if you're not familiar with Russia, here's Moscow right there where the star is. And this map shows some different vegetation zones. And what was interesting, if you look at where Moscow is, you see these different shading patterns. So this green is the boreal forest. Then right around Moscow, you have not boreal forest, but forest vegetation. And then this orange color represents steppe. And then this yellow down here is semi-desert. And this is in response to a climate gradient. And so you see these differences in vegetation. And Dukachev was working in this area, and he kind of saw this gradient and the effects that trees have on soil formation versus the effect of grasses. What happens is you increase precipitation in terms of, you know, depth to carbonates and things of that sort. So he really started to put some of these things together. It took a long time for a lot of these ideas to make it to the United States, though, just because of the language thing. So let's talk about the United States and what was going on here. Well, this, I've got a short sequence here of some world maps that show basically the spread and intensity of agricultural production. And I guess the background for this is that if we think about land use, you know, agricultural production is really going to be the most intensive and extensive use. So back in 1850, if you look at the United States, you can see that there's really nothing in the western United States. It's all in the east. And the way that these colors work, what they represent is the cool colors, the blues, represent very low intensity agricultural production. And then as you get into the yellows and the reds, it's more intensive. And in 1850, there was a lot of agriculture in this country. It was all east of the Mississippi, and it really wasn't that intensive, as you can see there. Well, what happened shortly after 1850 in terms of history in this country? What's that? The what?
The Homesteaders Act.
Okay, and what prompted that? Yeah, so we had Civil War, and everybody was pretty much occupied fighting. But after the Civil War, we started to see this really pronounced westward expansion. And if you look at the next in this sequence, it's going to jump to 1900. And you can see how things have pushed west, and in fact, to about the 100th meridian, which is really the separation between the humid and the semi-arid parts of the United States. And you'll also notice here in the upper Midwest, or what we would think of as the Corn Belt today, you start to see some of these redder colors, yellower colors, meaning that there's a lot more intensive agricultural use of the land. And if we fast forward again to 1950, you can see even more westward expansion and more intense use of ag lands in the Midwest. Well, the point being that this was really the driving factor behind the efforts to establish a soil survey program in this country. You know, Lewis and Clark came through across the country in the early 1800s, and part of what they were supposed to do part of their charge was to look at the potential for agriculture. And they pretty much left it as, well, if there was grass growing there, probably wasn't that good. If there were trees growing there, it's probably great agricultural land. And that's sort of been the rule of thumb for a long time. But once people started moving west and homesteading, there really was a much greater demand for information about land resources or soil resources. Where were the good agricultural areas? Where were they not so good? And this is what prompted the establishment of the soil survey program in this country, which began in 1899. So it's been ongoing now for 114 years or so. So it started early on. The problem was, even though these folks were charged to start developing soil surveys or soil inventories, they didn't have a classification system. And so I think you can appreciate the difficulty in trying to inventory something if you don't have the mechanism in place to describe these things. You know, like you have to say, well, these soils are kind of brown, these are kind of red, and that's really about all they could do. And early on, when the initial soil surveys began, most of what was being done was very much geological in nature. In other words, the surveys were based probably more than anything else, not on soils, but on the type of geology that you had, the rock type, or in some cases it might have been looked upon as coarse textured stuff, fine textured stuff. But there really wasn't a good system. And that's kind of what led to the development of the classification system, because I think you know that it's a map of the soil, the 12 soil orders in the U.S., and I've shown this to you before. How useful is this map for conducting a detailed soil survey? If you want to produce a product that is kind of indicative of where a good place to homestead is, for example, how helpful is this map going to be? Well, it might say, okay, this green, these are mollisol, so I bet you pretty much anywhere out there might be a good area. Yeah, for general purposes, it might be useful, but if you start looking at a particular area in Nebraska to homestead, I think you'll agree, you need something that's just a little bit more detailed. So this kind of points out the need for, not only do you need a classification system, but it can't be that general, like we're talking about with soil orders. You need to make it more specific so that you increase the utility more on a, not necessarily site-specific, but at least getting it down to a scale that is going to be useful for most people. Well, what happened in this country, this is back in the 1930s. There's this guy, Curtis Fletcher Marbot, and he is often referred to as the father of U.S. pedology. He's probably the first person that started looking at some of the work that Dukachev had done in Russia and getting some ideas about these broad patterns of soils and climate and vegetation as we might see in the United States. And he was in charge of the soil survey program. And so one of the directives that they were given is to try and come up with a more detailed type of a classification system. And so that's what he was doing. And you can see this table here, this is out of your book, but it's a soil classification that he put together, and it's dated 1935. So this is during the Dust Bowl era and the Depression and so on. But there were two things that he did, and you'll notice his system here. You've got category 6, and this would be the highest level of the system. Then there's category 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and you get down to some, if you look at it from top to bottom, you're going from very general to much more specific in terms of what's there. And what was interesting, you look at the highest levels, there's only two categories, pedalfers and pedicals. And what this referred to, notice the root in pedical, cal. So these were the soils that had calcium carbonate accumulation, or predominantly the ones that would be in the western United States. Pedalfers, it's kind of a made-up word, but notice the AL and FE. What do you think accumulates in those soils? Iron and aluminum. And so that was the separation of soils at the highest level, those that had carbonate accumulation and those that had iron and aluminum accumulation. Probably not the best way to do it, but what was important about this is he came up with what we would call a multi-categorical system. In other words, you have this top level, and then these are subdivided, and then those are subdivided further and further and further until you finally get down to some fairly specific or narrowly defined classification units. And the other thing that he did is, it down here, this lowest category here, the most detailed, it says soil units or types. And this was really the forerunner of this concept of the soil series, you know, where you've got this soil type in an area that's got a defined set of characteristics. And you might even recognize some of these words in here, like podzols and gray-brown podzolic soils and so on. Well, once this system came out, it started to, people began using it, and once that happened, people start coming up with suggestions for what might work better and what's wrong with the existing thing, and that's exactly what happened here. So Charles Kellogg, this guy, you notice he's the first one that you see here that doesn't have a beard or a mustache that's real noticeable. But what he was charged with, there was a document that comes out back in the day, and it was called the Yearbook of Agriculture. And this one is 1938, and notice the title on it, Soils and Men. So apparently women had nothing to do with soils or agriculture back in that day. But in this was published the first comprehensive classification system in the United States. And this handout that I gave you right here, and you won't have to know all of this for the exam on Thursday. I'm just kidding, but this is the whole system right here. And what you can see is that several features of this thing. Number one, it has category 6 over here, and you'll note they've got zonal soils, intrazonal soils, and azonal soils at the highest level. The zonal soils are simply those that you would describe as being the quote normal soil for an area. Like for around here, because we had grassland, vegetation, that a mollisol of some sort would probably be the zonal soil, okay? The azonal soils are the ones that are kind of weird in one way or another, and if you look on the ones down here, they've got some that are affected with salts, some that are affected with sodium, some that are really wet, the marshes and swamps, and then some of these others that they call them calomorphic, and it actually includes a few things in here, but some fairly clayey soils. Anyway, those would be oddball soils, and then down at the bottom you have what are called azonal soils, and these would be the really young soils or weakly developed ones that you'd find on steep slopes and floodplains. And in fact, they have what they call lithosols, which would be the real rocky soils, and then alluvial soils, which would be the floodplain ones, and then there's a category of just the sands, obviously the real sandy ones. So this was a real big step forward. And then you can see these guys are divided into suborders. And then in fact, they call them order, suborder, great soil group, family, series, and type. And this is very similar to what we use today. So even though this has undergone some changes, it really serves as the framework for soil taxonomy today. And with this 1938 Yearbook of Agriculture, Soil, and Men, there's a map in the back that I've got right here, and this is probably the first map of the United States that's got where there was an attempt to try and delineate different soils in different areas. And they're pretty broad units, but this idea of soil series you can find on here. In fact, if you look up here in the Palouse, you'll find some names like Santa, which I know some of you have run across when you did that homework exercise a few weeks ago, that are still in use, and they show them as being present here. But obviously, a map of this scale is not going to be very detailed. But as I said, this really was the first soil map of the United States that would be worth much. Well, there were a lot of problems with this system, and I maybe just mention a couple of them. But if you look on your list for the zonal soils up here, and you come over into the great soil groups, you come down here to see number 11, it says reddish prairie soils. Well, you might ask yourself, what is a reddish prairie soil? How do you define it? Well, here you go. Reddish prairie soils lie south of the region of true prairie soils. They have a redder color, probably due partly to the reddish color of the parent material and partly to the warmer climate under which they develop. These are for the most part productive soils, and much of the land is cultivated. The nice Renfro areas are the only representative areas of these soils. That's it. Now, would you be able to recognize a reddish prairie soil?
You betcha.
Well, you know, it'd be pretty difficult. And I've heard some stories from people who are no longer around, but they would go out and somebody would say, well, here's a good example of a reddish prairie soil. And nobody really knew exactly, you know, what the basis for calling it that was, other than it's probably got a reddish color to it. But that may not be the best criteria for defining a taxonomic unit. So I guess to summarize then, really the problem with this is that the different taxonomic units in here, or levels of taxonomy, were not very well defined. There was a lot of overlap, and it just really wasn't clear, say, where the reddish prairie soils start and the true prairie soils stop. You know, it's just way too general. So, you know, that was probably the main problem. There's just way too much overlap and not very precise definitions of these things. Well, the next thing that happened is, you think about the timeline here. Remember this guy, Hans Jenny, Factors of Soil Formation? Well, this was published in 1941, so it's just a couple years after this 1938 Yearbook of Agriculture came out. And Hans Jenny was the one that suggested that if you look at any soil, what you're seeing there is the function of the interaction between climate, organisms, relief, parent material, and time. And I know we've talked about this quite a bit, and maybe you just accept this as truth, but prior to this, at least in the United States, nobody had really been able to express this idea of these environmental factors, state factors, flux factors, interacting to produce a given soil type. And once this came out, you know, people looked at this and said, yeah, you know, climate is pretty influential. And in fact, as the development of soil taxonomy went on, people realized, yeah, climate is really important, not only for the formation of soils, but also for the types of, or the effect that it has on land use, and especially for agricultural purpose. And the same thing with organisms and relief and parent material, time to a much lesser extent. I mean, that really doesn't work its way into the classification system directly, but these other things do, as we're going to see. Well, things progressed along with this revision of this 1938 system, and it took a while, but in 1975, there was the publication of Soil Taxonomy, and it's this green book right here. You can see how thick it is. This was the result of 7 different approximations of this that they went through, and it went out for review and then revision. And this thing was finally published in 1975. So really, it's not that long ago. Now we're talking about, what, 37 years, something like that. It's really not terribly long ago. And this actually had some really important features that had not been used prior to this in any sort of a soil classification system. And the guy responsible for this is named Guy Smith. You can see him there. He was in charge of the soil survey division. And I guess, I never met the guy, but from all accounts, he was fairly autocratic. You know, it was his way or the highway kind of guy. Which, if you think about it, may not be a bad type of mentality to have if you're trying to get some sort of a system developed and in place. Somebody's got to make the decisions. And apparently he did, much to the dismay of some other folks sometimes. But he had a lot of foresight into how the system should be set up and the features that it should have. And so he's not really the author of Soil Taxonomy. If you look at this book, the author is often given as the soil survey staff. And that includes people from what was the Soil Conservation Service, the Soil Survey Division of the Soil Conservation Service, the other agencies like the Forest Service, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Bureau of Land Management, and even the land-grant universities around the country. And it was really a cooperative effort in terms of putting this thing together. Guy Smith is simply the person who more or less oversaw the whole thing. Okay, well, some features of soil taxonomy that are really important to think about. Number one is that it was determined that because of this 1938 system not having very precise definitions, soil taxonomy is what we would call a quantitative system. In other words, the categories that you find in here are based on measurable or observable properties that can be quantified. And by this point in the semester, you guys are all familiar with some of these things. Like, you can actually go out and observe soil texture or come up with a measure and a percent clay. Or you can take a Munsell book and you can look at the color value of a sample and have a quantitative measure of its lightness or darkness. Well, we'll see lots of examples of this, but for right now, just remember that the taxonomic units in soil taxonomy have quantitative definitions. In other words, there is a definite and specified range placed on certain types of properties, whether it's texture or color, chemical properties, pH, lots of things like that. And one of the other aspects of soil taxonomy was that it is all-inclusive. It was set up as a key. And what that means is you work your way down through a key. You've all used them. You start with the first branch in the key, and you either go one way or the other, and then you end up, by default, with a final category. And what that means is that every single soil that you classify ends up in one and only one category. There's absolutely no overlap. And this was a problem with the 1938 system. One of the other features of this that was recognized as being an important consideration was that it had to be able, you had to be able to use this on both managed and native soils, or cultivated and uncultivated soils, or forested or harvested soils, with the idea being that the effects of typical management practices should not affect the classification of the soil. You don't want to change the classification of the soil simply by going out and cutting some trees on a site or plowing up the surface. And so that was kind of built into it. And then the last thing that was a feature of this that was very different was that it could be easily expanded. And this is the idea of a key, in part, is that you've got these categories in there and you're able to go in, and as more information becomes available, you can add more categories in there. They're easily fit into the system. And one of the things that Guy Smith realized is even back in 1975, we really did not know much about the soils from a lot of the humid tropical areas of the world. There just hadn't been a lot of research done. Similarly, we didn't know much about the soils from really cold areas that have permafrost in them. And he recognized that over time, yeah, more information is going to become available. And as that happens, we're going to have more categories in the system. If you go back and look at this version of soil taxonomy that came out in 1975, there are only 10 soil orders in it. And I think most of you are aware that there's 12 of them now. So that kind of shows how the system can be expanded. So anyway, this was unlike any soil classification system that existed anywhere. And it had these features that I just went through that made it very different. So I'm going to maybe take a couple minutes here, and I think for some of you this is going to be reviewed, but just the structure of soil taxonomy and how it's set up. If we start the highest level of the system, what do we call it? The highest level of soil taxonomy, the most general categories. Yeah, the soil orders. And there are 12 of these now in taxonomy. The two new ones that got added after soil taxonomy first came out were the andisols and the gelisols. Interesting, in Idaho, how many soil orders do you think we have here? Anybody want to guess? That's a very good guess, and that is how many we have. Washington, I think, there are probably 11, because in Washington, I know up on Mount Rainier, there are some gelisols. We don't have any in Idaho, but the one thing Washington doesn't have is oxisols. But we've got a pretty good representation of these things out here. What's the next level down? Well, it's what we call the suborder. And currently, there are 68 of these in the system. And I have no idea how many are in Idaho. I really don't. We won't worry about that. Anybody know the next level down? Well, some of these terms you recognize from that 1938 system, but we have what's known as the Great Group. And there are currently, I think, 316 of these things. It does change from time to time. Below the Great Group, we have the Not-So-Great Group. Actually, they're called subgroups. And currently in the system, 2,484 of these. And then we get down to what's known as the family. And in families, we've got to round off here, somewhere on the order of about 8,000. And then we get into soil series. And it's estimated now that there are about 19,000 of these things in the U.S. And in Idaho, we've estimated somewhere around 1,000. And I suspect Washington would even be a little bit higher than that. And we can actually put one more division down here that's used for survey, and that's called a phase. And that's actually, we talk about a phase of a soil series, like the Palouse silt loam. We might have a Palouse silt loam that's the eroded phase, or something like that. It's just a mapping thing. We're not really going to be talking about this. We're going to focus on order and then down to the series level. So I think you get the idea here with this type of a multi-categorical system that you have increasing specificity as you get down to the bottom, where any soil in the world goes into one of 12 categories or orders. But when you get down to the series level, these things are pretty narrowly defined. And that's why there's so many of them. So this is the layout of the system. And then I guess the next point that I want to make here is that if you look at the higher levels of the system, and we're talking about order, suborder, great group, probably somewhere in here, that the classification or the placement into these higher levels of the system is based on, I'm going to write this out, presence or absence of something that we call diagnostic horizons and features. So the placement into these higher categories, order, suborder, great group, is based, and even subgroup to some extent, is based on the presence or absence of these diagnostic horizons and features. Does anybody happen to know an example of a diagnostic horizon or a diagnostic feature? Well, there are a lot of them, and you'll be happy to know that we've already talked about them to some degree. We just haven't called them these things. But for example, the other day we're talking about the rangeland productivity in Montana. We talked about a mollic epipedon, this thick, dark surface horizon. That's an example of a diagnostic horizon. And it's also the diagnostic horizon that generally defines the mollisol order. And there are a lot more of these things, but we're going to go into them in more detail. But as I said, the good news is you're already going to be familiar with most of these things. So we base the placement on the presence or absence of diagnostic horizons and features, and the other thing that figures very prominently into this is something we call soil moisture and soil temperature regimes. So really what you need to know to figure out the classification of a soil is the types of diagnostic horizons or features that it has or doesn't have, and soil moisture and temperature regimes. So now if we're going to understand the classification system, and you all are going to get very familiar with it, what do we need to focus on next? Probably diagnostic horizons and features and soil moisture and temperature regimes, since no one indicated they really knew what these things were. So that's really what we're going to be focused on for the next couple of class periods. And I want to, we'll come back to this concept of a diagnostic horizon or feature for a minute, because that is what we're going to take up next. Diagnostic horizon or horizons. Now, as a general definition, what we could say is that these diagnostic horizons are soil horizons that have specific and defined properties. Now remember the first thing that I listed when we're talking about why soil taxonomy was different than other classification systems? I said it was a quantitative system. Well, this is one of the ways that it figures in here, where we start defining what these diagnostic horizons are. And the most of them are, as I said, quantitatively defined. Let me give you an example. We have something that is used a lot in the classification system, one of these diagnostic horizons, and it's called an argillic horizon. Anybody want to guess what that is? Argillic horizon.
Isn't that a clay
thing? It's a zone of clay accumulation. All right? You recognize that root, argy? Okay? So this would probably, if we were looking at an argillic diagnostic horizon, it's probably going to be, what, a BT horizon of some sort? Well, this is very widely used in the system, and if you look at an example of this idea of specified and defined properties, for an argillic horizon, in order to qualify, the argillic horizon has to have 1.2 times as much clay as the overlying horizon. There's the quantitative aspect of it, 1.2 times as much clay. So I'm going to draw two soil profiles here. Just to illustrate this point, I think this is pretty important. So let's say we go out in the field and we're looking at some soils around here. We've got an A horizon, and we know that there's some sort of a B horizon down here, okay? Well, you guys are getting really good at hand texturing. So we hand texture the A horizon, and we determine it's got 30% clay in it, all right? You get down into what you think is the B horizon, and you do the hand texture, and you decide it's got 40% clay. So how would you designate that B horizon? We would put a what on it? The subordinate distinction T, because there's an accumulation of clay there, right? As determined by the hand texturing. Now, let me ask you a question. Is that BT horizon an argillic horizon, going by the definition of the quantitative limits used in soil taxonomy? Do you have 1.2 times as much clay? Yeah, you do, because if you take 30% clay multiply by 1.2, that's 36% clay, and we've got 40 down here. And I know everyone's hand texturing is good enough to distinguish 4% clay. So this would be a BT horizon, our designation, and it would also qualify as an argillic horizon in soil taxonomy. And probably somewhere in its classification, not at the order level, but probably suborder, great group, or even subgroup level, there's going to be an indication that this argillic horizon is present. Now, just another example. Doing another soil around here, same thing, we do the hand texture, the A horizon, 30% clay, we come down into the B horizon, and we texture it, and say we come up with 34% clay. How would you designate that horizon in the field? Yeah, it's still a BT horizon because you are detecting an increase in clay, right? Now, is this one going to be an argillic horizon? No, because it does not have 1.2 times as much clay as the overlying horizon. So, keep this in mind, and this is really important, that even though these diagnostic horizons will generally be related to a horizon designation we've talked about, they're not exactly the same thing. For example, I would say that probably all argillic horizons are BT horizons, but not all BT horizons are going to be argillic horizons, okay? And this is true of things like calcic horizons. Calcic horizon probably refers to what? Accumulation of calcium carbonate. And again, quantitative limits. Okay, I'm going to stop there, and we'll pick up on this Thursday.